Welcome to the Changing Scripts podcast, where we chat with people about their language learning stories. Right now, we're focusing on Mandarin Chinese, but we'll be expanding out to other languages in the future. My name is Stephanie, and I was an English language instructor for about 15 years, mostly in Asia. Also, last year, I learned how to read very basic Mandarin Chinese through the HSK Chinese language test materials. I am currently on an indefinite language learning break, but I still enjoy talking to people about their language learning journeys. Fun fact, while I was studying Chinese last year, I documented the process on the Changing Scripts YouTube channel, so feel free to have a peek at those videos if you wish. In this episode, we talk with Angela, a Canadian who went to China for the first time in 2006, which is where she met her husband. She left China and returned, as many expats do. Lucky for me, she came back to China in 2010 and worked at the same school that I did, where we were teaching academic English to students who were about to study abroad. Angela's relationship to languages and language learning is the complete opposite to mine. Before learning Mandarin Chinese, she fluently learned French, Spanish, and Finnish, with a strong emphasis on speaking the language. She is now a teacher in Canada and also is able to help international students from China and other countries adapt to their new learning and academic environments, as well with smaller study groups. A note to the sound sensitive, Angela's adorable baby boy, Morgan, joined us for some part of this conversation. I have edited out the vast majority of the sounds that overpowered Angela and my voice, but there are a few softer baby noises that I left in because Angela's story is so amazing, I didn't want to cut those parts of it out too. If you are someone who will be annoyed by such subtle baby sounds, please feel free to listen to the first 30 minutes of this podcast episode, that's before Morgan joined us, and then return next month for a different episode of Changing Scripts. If you have any questions or comments as you're listening to this episode, I welcome feedback, comments, questions, anything at all. On all social media platforms, I am Steph Fuccio, S-T-E-P-H-F-U-C-C-I-O. I respond to any and all feedback, and I love knowing what you think of these conversations. Let's meet Angela and Morgan and find out about Angela's language learning stories. Welcome to the Changing Scripts podcast, Angela. So happy to talk to you.
Yes, it's lovely.
First, I was like, no, I can't ask people I know for any of the podcasts because that's cheating. And now I'm like, wait, I can just use this as an excuse to get in contact with everybody I haven't talked to for a while.
Right. It's actually kind of wonderful.
Right? Mm-hmm. Full disclaimer, I have known Angela for quite... When did we meet? 2010, 2011?
Yeah, 2011.
2011. Yes. Well into your Mandarin experience. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing you for the first week you were at the school. Let's be vague. Mm. Like chatting away with the locals. And I was like, damn, she's good. But let's backtrack to how you started. I have these theories about first languages, second languages, and I don't think that adults and children learn as different as some people do. So I like to dissect how people learn their first language just a little bit. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to Canada to baby Angela. Before you started school, or any part of learning English?
I know from stories and things like that, and I kind of have a sense, I guess, of that, but my mom stayed at home with us, and so there was lots of reading together and talking. I'm from a pretty big family, so lots of interactions with somewhat same age peers, but then also my mom was part of some different mom groups, I guess you could say, and I was present for those kinds of meetings as well, and apparently really liked to participate.
Like book groups or what kinds of?
Like parenting groups, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, the other kids would play with each other and I would want to participate with the adults. I mean, I think I played with them too, or I'd like to think I played with them too. That was kind of the beginning. There was lots of reading. I don't know, not necessarily much in the way of writing. I was not at that point yet, but lots of encouragement to join in conversations. When I think of myself now as a parent and as I think about language acquisition with my son, who we're hoping will be bilingual with English and Mandarin, just thinking about the use of kind of complete language when you're interacting with your child. Mm-hmm. And that was something that my parents really did with me in terms of modeling that. And then in terms of kind of engaging me in different things and talking through things we were doing together.
What do you mean by complete language? Do you mean like people sometimes talk to children like in very simplified language? Do you mean not doing that?
So not doing that as much and using kind of the real words for things.
Okay.
Rather than using the child or baby words for things. My parents were intentional about kind of using real words for whatever it was that we were doing. Yeah.
Let's stay with your childhood and then we'll loop back around because I'm very curious linguistically what's happening with your son.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, at any point in elementary school or before then or whatnot, did you gravitate towards reading or writing or speaking? Or like most people seem to kind of have a comfort area in one of those, but not necessarily all of them.
Mm-hmm. I think that writing was probably the one I would say I gravitated to the least. I don't know if that has a relationship with kind of the order in which we tend to start to kind of do things as we're beginning. So when I started kindergarten, I was in French immersion. And so started kind of with a second language. And I found a couple of books and I know that my mom had kind of tried to introduce me a little bit to French, but really when I went to kindergarten, that was when it was like waffle on. The teacher that we had was French first language and spoke very little English. So it was a fully immersed kind of environment for French that way, which was a big transition, I think. I can't say that I remember a lot of it, but I do know that the focus was much more on, you know, the speaking and then working into the reading before we really got into the writing. So wow, okay. The writing wasn't emphasized as much that way. Yeah. Right.
Okay, let's back up a second because I sillily assumed that English was your first language. Was English your first
language? It is. Yes. Okay. Yes.
When you went to kindergarten or first grade is when you went into the French immersion school?
Kindergarten. So I had half days in French starting in kindergarten. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Can we tell the listeners the general area in Canada that you're in?
So I'm in central Canada. I live in Winnipeg now. I grew up in a small town in northern Manitoba called Flin Flon. So there are about 5,000 people. So it's a pretty big deal to have a French first language teacher teaching French immersion there. But we had someone running our French immersion program who was originally from Quebec, which is the French language province in Canada, and she brought who kind of would go back every summer and recruit people to come up to Flin Flon and teach.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, that's why I was kind of surprised because I always assumed that it's like Quebec and whatnot that's going to be French immersion.
Right.
Okay, so you were in a French immersion school from when you were in kindergarten till what grade?
Till grade 8. Yeah, so kindergarten to grade 8 was French immersion. And then when I went to high school, we didn't have the numbers to be able to maintain a full French immersion program. So we had, you know, maybe a couple of courses that you could do, but otherwise it's switched then to being mostly English.
Because 4 is pretty early. So did French feel like a fairly easy thing to slip into or was it a struggle?
I mean, I think some parts of it were pretty easy to slip into in some ways in the sense of like, I think conversationally by grade 2 or 3, there was quite a bit that I could communicate. But I think it also coming back to that idea of writing, as I think about it now, you know, writing is kind of that place where you can come back and notice what's wrong with the grammar or what's wrong with this or that or whatever. And so I think was also the place in my language acquisition kind of journey with French that was the most structured, but also maybe the least fun because of that.
You know, you could see the mistakes in there.
Right. And it was about, you know, now you need to learn the grammar or the verb conjugation or the whatever, rather than just a way of expressing myself. So if I was going to think about expressing myself in a written way, it would always be English. And you know, all the way through, no matter how proficient I felt, I still would rather do it in English. Whereas if I was speaking, I still certainly preferred English. The rest of my kind of language context was English all the time, right? It was just at school that it was French. And so I think I still kind of associated French with that environment. Mm-hmm. And despite my mom's best efforts, was not willing to chat with her in French ever.
Right. So in a French immersion school, all subjects are in French, right?
Growing up, it was everything except for our English class and then music and phys ed. Phys were done in English because the special teachers that we had to teach those did not speak French. Then our classroom teacher did the science, social studies, math, all of that in French.
Now, we have some friends who did a French immersion school further east. I don't remember exactly where in Canada because I suck with geography. They said when they started teaching, not A-levels, the IB program in an international school, they said they had to learn the English words for some things that they only had like French content words for. Did you ever have that kind of experience?
When I transitioned to high school and then all of my science, social studies, everything was in English, science was the biggest one where I went, my goodness, okay. I remember grade 9 science going, I have to relearn kind of all of this terminology. Like, I think I know what they're talking about, but I don't know what word to pull from to talk about that. I wouldn't say that it was a hindrance, but it was an added level of kind of difficulty as we were transitioning to that program, for sure.
Do you have conscious memories of having learned French at school, or because you were so young, did it feel like it just kind of happened?
If I think back to kind of the very, you know, those early years, I don't have really strong memories of that. I have memories more of the songs that we would sing, I think. So I think a lot of it was done through music sometimes, or different kinds of songs, as we, even if we think of the way we kind of start that with young children in their first language often, where we have those kinds of songs. A lot of that was used, I think, as we were learning French as well. But if I go into, you know, thinking about my time in kind of junior high and high school, it's funny because everything was in French, except only French class felt like that was the time we were learning French.
Oh, that's interesting.
When I think about myself as a teacher now, and especially working with international students who are English language learners, we spend a lot of time talking about how every teacher is a language teacher. You're teaching language through math, through science, through whatever, and you may have other content that you're teaching, but you're still teaching language. But as a student, I didn't think of it that way. I think I thought of, you know, French class was when we learned French, and that's when we worked on our grammar or whatever. And the big things, I think, and for me, and I think generally the big kind of focus when learning French is that kind of verb conjugation. That's a huge part of it. And then masculine, feminine, differentiating that, because we don't have that in English the same way. So that was a big part of the focus at that time, was getting that kind of grammar straight. Working on vocabulary, of course, I don't know if maybe because we were immersed in French and our other subjects, that idea of growing our vocabulary super intentionally in that way wasn't as much a focus of our French class. Like, our French class was kind of like a grammar class.
So it sounds like the French class wasn't terribly enjoyable experience?
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, I don't know if I think back, it's probably not one of the ones that we necessarily looked forward to. Although I did have some lovely French teachers who found ways to kind of keep things interesting as they could. But yeah, that's probably a fair statement.
Even just thinking about what you said within just an English language curriculum, it's also true.
Yes.
We had English class. I was at the end of, in the US, when they stopped explicitly making you diagram out sentences and do stuff like that in like elementary school and junior high. Like, Evan didn't, but I did. And so I remember those classes is where I learned grammar, like English grammar and that kind of thing. But every single class we were in, we were learning vocabulary. We were learning things about the language.
Learning,
it was always language used. Yeah.
Right. And it was modeling different types of language in different, different registers or that kind of thing, right? Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because the formality in different subjects and, It's interesting, though. This really, really brings up the idea of, like, explicitly doing kind of the torturous analyzation of language. Does that move anything along?
I wonder.
Just usage, Well, let's compare this to Mandarin then. Let's hop ahead. Well, hold on.
Sure.
Between French and Mandarin Chinese, did you learn any other languages?
I was trying to get as many French credits as I could in high school. So I took Spanish and French because it was offered through distance education. Figure that out. But whatever, that's how it was.
What?
So I took a distance education Spanish class in French, which just meant that the book was written in French for me to learn Spanish. And then I had to like record tapes and send it back to wherever for my tests and exams and those kinds of things. I continued and took a couple of Spanish courses in university as well. But between high school and university, I spent a year as an exchange student in Finland. Mm-hmm. And that really threw me for a loop because up until that point, I had been doing English only and then French and then Spanish. And French and Spanish are both very similar in structure to English. And so it was very much just, you know, you could almost guess words without having learned them necessarily. And I went to Finland and went like, okay, so this is a very different structure.
Wow.
The way they organize their language is really different. And they use like prepositions or suffixes rather than separate words. And you can put three of them together. Mm. And it just blew my mind. And you add the suffixes to the adjectives, not just to the nouns. So, you know, I was thinking like in this small house would be like pianessa and then kutissa. So you add the SSA, which means in, to small and house. So that was a whole different way of thinking about language. I think when I then went to China and started learning some Mandarin, prepared me maybe a little bit more for how different learning Mandarin is. You know, I wasn't expecting to be able to rely on the same strategies necessarily that I had used in learning French or English or Spanish.
Is Finnish an agglomerative language then? You kind of add stuff onto the main word to just...
You can add so much to the end of things, which is... And words get very long.
Yeah.
but it's also... Finnish was the... You know, in comparison to French and Spanish... Mm-hmm. Or English, there are so many exceptions that we have in these languages. And I think because there's such kind of a mix, you know, of all of these different languages, there's so many influences. And so depending on the influence, the rules maybe work a little differently, right? Like I remember when I was learning Spanish and we're going, why is this the permanent verb to be instead of the temporary one? And they said, well, you have to think about Catholicism. And, you know, so to die is temporary, but to get married is permanent. Because that is how it works within the church. And so the verb to be that is associated with that is the temporary one for one and the permanent one for the other. So there's so many exceptions in those senses. And you need to understand so much about that to get that, right?
Die is temporary. To get married is permanent.
Right. Not the way we would think about it now.
No. And in this realm of thinking, when you die, are you still married? Obviously, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's permanent, even your life is temporary. Wow.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wow. You mentioned that your methods had to change. How did you say French and Spanish?
French and Spanish, I think a lot of it I could guess in terms of there being lots of vocabulary that kind of was consistent across English, French, Spanish. And then the big focus was on, like I was saying, kind of verb conjugation. And like the feminine masculine was the little things that would trip you up. And then the verb conjugation was the, am I actually getting my meaning across here? You know, and if you could get the verb conjugated fairly well, then you probably were going to have people understand what you meant. But if you didn't, you were going to be way off. And so, you know, there was still some things related maybe to pronunciation, but pronunciation was never something that I would, you know, sit and practice the sounds necessarily. Whereas if I think about when I was learning Mandarin, I was like, no, but how should my tongue be? Let me see your mouth. How are you doing that? There weren't sounds in French and Spanish that were as foreign to me that my ear really couldn't even pick up as much. So maybe in Spanish, I practiced that rolling R for a bit. But otherwise, there wasn't as much of that. Whereas when I learned Finnish, there was a bit more of that kind of pronunciation practice. And I had a little pocket dictionary that I carried with me everywhere I went so that I could look up words and try and figure things out. And it took longer to get to a point where I felt like I kind of knew what was happening around me, which I would say is similar with Chinese. Although the big difference with Chinese that I found was I couldn't use a dictionary anymore. And I didn't know how to cope with that. I didn't know what the alternative was supposed to be, because when I first went to China and no smartphones.
That's what I was just going to ask you.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
no.
None of that holding up Google Translate or whatever to things, right? And I remember going, okay, I mean, I can look up an English word and find it in Chinese, but I can't look up a Chinese word. How would I do that? You know, and I remember asking somebody, they said, well, you, and I said, no, like, I don't know when I look at it, how many strokes are in this character. I don't know how to identify that. Does the little dot thing count as a stroke? I don't know. Which way do I count? You know, like I was confused. So that was really different. And it became more, sorry, I'm mixing all of them. I'm not doing any of this in any particular order.
I don't care.
Okay.
No, it's like languages are messy. We just how things are. Yeah.
So backtracking a little bit, I went to Finland as part of being an exchange student in Finland. I went through the road Rotary International Exchange Program. And so the Rotary Club there that sponsored me, one of the things that they do for all of their exchange students is they enroll them in Finnish language classes. So I went to a night class once a week. I was in, you know, a regular Finnish high school. Thankfully, people in Finland have excellent English.
So your classes in the high school were in Finnish?
Yes. Yes. I took the Spanish class and the French class and the English class. Okay. And I took art and I took them so that I could kind of participate without necessarily having as much language and do more of the watching and whatever. You know, because I had already graduated from high school, the courses I took didn't matter that much in terms of credit. I did take a health class and I remember trying to take notes in that class. And it was just funny. You know, I said, like, this is just my chance to try and see what letters tend to go together in this language. Because unlike taking notes in English, taking notes in English, you go, okay, you know, you see a phrase and you remember it and you write it down. But in Finnish, I was going letter by letter.
What was your inspiration for wanting to go to Finland? Why did this happen?
Within the Rotary Exchange Program, you kind of get to make a choice of, you can kind of rank your top three countries that you would like to go to. But then they have a bit of a matching system because clubs that send students will receive students. So Finland hadn't actually been one of my choices, but it just ended up being where I was going, which worked out really well. But yeah, I hadn't necessarily ever considered Finland as an option or a place I really wanted to go. Which, when we fast forward to China, kind of a similar thing happened. So that's funny.
Really?
Yeah. I initially did my kind of EAL certification stuff with the idea of going to Brazil. And after I did it, I didn't have my university degree yet. I was taking a year off from university. And the summer after I took the program, Brazil changed its work visa rules. And you needed an undergrad to go teach there. So the company that I kind of did the certification through, they had some kind of teacher placement service that they offered as well. And I contacted them and said, okay, so if I can't go to Brazil, you know, where can I go? And they said, well, China's hiring. I said, oh, well, I never thought of that, but okay, let's see what that looks like. So that's how that happened. Also, kind of not necessarily by intention, but just by being flexible with what the circumstances were.
I guess I always thought that you studied Mandarin a lot before you went to work there, but you didn't. You went there and then learned it.
With nothing, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. When I first got to China, I remember them taking us. They showed us how to do numbers with our hands so that we could buy things at the market. Initially, we had been promised kind of a weekly Mandarin lesson, and I was very excited about that. And it never really materialized. And I think maybe we had one. You know, it was taught by just kind of someone who was in the office, and they went, well, you know Mandarin, so teach these foreigners some Mandarin.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so they did, you know, they picked a couple of characters. I think it was the, like, ma, 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 whatever, you know. That contrast between them, and they had us practice our tones and wrote up the characters and whatever. But what I actually started doing is I went, okay, every time I take a taxi, they want to talk to me. And I know that there's probably, you know, 5 or 6 questions that they're choosing from to ask me. Like, where are you from? What are you doing here? Do you like it? Whatever.
Right.
So I went into one day when I was picking up my paycheck, I said, okay, I think these are the questions they're asking me. Can you write this out for me? What does the question sound like and what does the answer sound like? And we wrote it out in pinyin, and then I wrote the English underneath and I carried it with me. And that was like my beginning of going, I need to start learning something in this language just because it was awkward in taxis. Okay, so if I go back, let's go back to Finland, because one of the things that I found, like I had taken some Spanish in high school and found it not super challenging necessarily. I went to Finland, came back, and Finnish words came out of my mouth. In the past, when I had been learning Spanish, if I didn't know the Spanish word, French word would pop out. That was kind of, I call it my default second language. But I had just spent a year in Finland. My new default second language was Finnish. So I was, you know, doing a role play or something with a partner in a class. They looked at me really confused. It took me a moment to realize that a Finnish word had come out of my mouth, not a Spanish or French word. And if you slip up with French, time is close enough that it's okay. But if you slip up with Finnish, not much in common there.
Yeah, I didn't have many time words for months and months and months when I first started studying Chinese last year. So, I know like this much of Spanish, but verbs are primarily like, well, no, wait, verbs. No, I knew, okay. I never really got inflections right in Spanish because I learned it mostly in person and with taxi drivers, funny enough. Yes. And very cute boys because I was single at the time and those kinds of things. And so I just ended up using time words with verbs and people were way too friggin' forgiving. So what happened is when I started learning Chinese last year, I was using Chinese like nouns and verbs because those were the primary vocabulary coming in HSK 1 and 2. And like Spanish time words would come into my head and be like, no, that's not working. It's not going to work.
Block.
Yeah.
Why is there a wall here?
But it was very confusing because I never got to a decent level in Spanish. So I was like, how could you be showing up? Why isn't English showing up right now? I'm supposed to be speaking foreign right now. So I'm going to that language. Yeah.
Go to the not English. The best not English you have.
Exactly. It cracked me up so much. I'm like, I don't have any real second language that I can communicate with, but y'all are going to kind of just take turns going at the half-ass kind of way. Coming back to China, because we're going to ping pong back and forth. You were talking to taxi drivers. They're like, how did you keep going with that?
I didn't take any classes. I would say that I'm one of those kind of, I don't know if it's abnormal or normal or what people, but when I travel, I like to go somewhere for a while. And I like to kind of get to know the people there. Any chance I had to kind of get to know people and actually spend a bit more time with them and maybe learn a little bit from them, I tried to take that. But I found actually a similar problem to when I was in Finland, where everyone would rather practice their English with me than help me to learn Chinese or Finnish necessarily, right?
Right.
I just kind of kept plodding along and making my way through. My language in Mandarin consisted mostly of ordering lamian and and saying that I didn't eat fish.
Right. And Do you not eat fish?
I don't eat fish or seafood. So I'm not allergic, but I don't like them.
What? Okay.
Yeah, it's shocking to most people I meet in China, especially because that's like the good food. So I always needed to eat before I went to a wedding because I knew that most of the food I wouldn't actually want to eat.
Right.
I'd have my sandwich beforehand, fill up a little. Yes, that was kind of the beginning. I went on a trip in the summer. It must have been October. I think it was October. We went on a trip. And, you know, that was when we're kind of in a new place and you need to be able to use your Mandarin, right? All of a sudden, the survival component of it becomes a little bit more important because it's not your familiar kind of space. So there were many, many things that I did not know, but I felt confident enough by that point to kind of go out on my own and figure things out. I was with a friend as well. You know, not I wasn't alone necessarily, I guess. I think my Mandarin was a bit stronger than hers at that point. I usually say that first year, it was kind of your basic survival Mandarin was what I could do. And there was little to no reading involved in that whatsoever. It would just be finding people and asking. And even now, I'd say that I'm pretty much functionally illiterate. I can do some very easy things, but most things I need to ask. And so if I'm at a restaurant and I want to order food, I'll say, well, do you have this?
And
they go, yeah, you know, it's on page 3, blah, blah, blah. And I go, yeah.
It's a hell of a script. See, I'm the total opposite of you though. And I'm jealous because I feel like most ways that Mandarin or most languages are taught are vocal first and people will focus on the conversation. And
right.
I think that's why one of the big reasons is I haven't learned a second language is I need something to connect it to. I'm like hanging stuff on tons of characters right now and it's working a lot better than any other time I've tried to learn a language. It's slow. It's super slow, but it's I'm still doing it a year and a half later, which I cannot say for any other language. I can't learn just from hearing. I can't, even if it's like repeated 200 times and somebody's asking me the same 5 questions, I'll just be like, just going like straight over. But I'm so jealous because so many classes and so many people I meet are like you where they can pick it up by using it, by just hearing it. I'm just not on that page.
你好,我是 Tom. Hello, this is Tom. I hope you are enjoying Angela's language learning story. I wanted to take a minute of your time to tell you a little bit of my language story now. I'm French and I'm currently doing a master's degree in Chinese studies with a major in Chinese literature and translation. I fell in love with the Chinese language when I first started studying it at high school. It will be 9 years ago already. I'm actually sharing my little journey on my Instagram account, where I also share the books that I'm reading, things that inspire me to stay productive, and many more while trying my best to keep everything aesthetically pleasing and motivating. I first found Changing Scripts through the YouTube channel. In fact, it was a video where Steph talked about a book reading series called Graded Chinese Readers. After watching it, I immediately bought the first volume and fell in love with it. The books contain abridged versions of short stories and novellas written by contemporary Chinese writers, so you get to read Chinese books and get exposed to Chinese literature. And let me tell you that learning Chinese while reading is truly amazing and encouraging at the same time. That's why I absolutely love Graded Readers books. Self will have more information about these books in the show notes for you. I'm also excited to tell you that on July 9th, 6 days after my birthday, my episode of Changing Scripts will be available then. Yes, you can come back and find out more about my language learning experiences. Until then, feel free to follow me on Instagram at tomreads, T-H-O-M-R-E-A-D-S. And now, let's get back to Angela's language learning story.
Now, I think maybe one of the regrets that I have when I think of what you're saying is that I relied so heavily on pinyin that I didn't have that kind of built-in necessity trying to figure out the characters. So I just skipped them. And now it's like a slowing down to have to go back and learn them, which is frustrating and yet something that I think would be useful. So I now joke that I'll learn them along with Morgan as he learns them. But you know, we'll see if that happens or not. But hopefully we'll be able to kind of do that. At one point I had an app for learning Mandarin characters, you know, and you draw them before bed and blah, blah, blah. But once you get up to 70, how many can you draw? How many can you, you know, like
a lot.
The app stopped loading on my phone because there were too many things to load, I think.
For months I was doing this app that would have like, it would have it in HSK categories, which I didn't even think I was going to start taking the test at that point, but it would have it like drop down. It was like this game where the character would drop down and you'd have to trace it in the right order before it hit the bottom.
Yes. Were there little snowflakes on it?
Yeah.
I think we used the same one.
Yes. I love that thing. But it was fun. And I was doing it on the metro sometimes in Shanghai. And like Chinese people would look at me and be like, ooh.
Cool.
They're like, you can do that well. I'm like, I'm tracing. I'm not even actually writing.
Right. Yeah. And that was why it was okay for me, because I could just trace it.
Yeah.
But I thought this will give me a sense. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what, a lot of people really insist that you have to handwrite stuff. And I handwrite my paper flashcards for a number of reasons that are not important. But honestly, if I write in the future, I'm going to be typing on my phone or on my computer. So I made a decision a while ago. I'm not going to handwrite the characters. It doesn't make any sense. I can type now on my phone. I haven't set it up on my computer yet, but I can, if I can recognize the character, I'm good, because I do the, you know, pinyin input thing and I find it and it works. I can send messages doing that with like 300 words that I know, but it's possible.
Yes.
That's what I see happening. I don't see myself writing out stuff like letters and things.
No, exactly. It's almost learning the writing as a way of supporting the reading.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just where you're kind of familiarizing yourself with the smaller differences between the characters.
Exactly. And this may come to bite me in the ass as I get more vocabulary under my belt, but right now it seems to be okay.
Yeah. Good.
So who knows? Cool. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's interesting though, because you said figuring out the characters instead of just learning the characters. And I think that's really interesting because I had this conversation with a gentleman who grew up with English and Chinese a couple of weeks ago. And he was kind of giggling at, no, when you grow up with Mandarin, you don't really play with them. You don't envision what they look like. You just learn them. You just rote memorize them. And that's what you do. And then you use them to get meaning. Or you use it to convey meaning. He's like, we don't really do that stuff with them. And I was like, oh, I do.
The way that we try to kind of make it fun and interesting for adult Mandarin language learners or whatever is not necessarily what they actually do. No, when you have to learn, you know, 300 a week rather than 300 a year or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's so true. It's so true. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily bad with that. It is kind of fun historical linguistic wise. It's kind of interesting, but I think you can get lost in it and forget to keep going with more words because you have to have a certain amount to get some meaning in somewhere. But it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah, if the ultimate goal is communication, that can't be the only focus, right?
Yeah. And you also said that you draw, not write.
Yes.
Characters. And I say that all the time because I'm like, it feels like an art form to me.
Absolutely. And I've actually said to my husband, who is Chinese, before my family came for our wedding, I said, we need to put together a little thing that has some of the common phrases that they may need to say that they can just point to because they can't look things up. And he said, well, what do you mean they can't look things up? And I said, no, because you have pictures. And he goes, well, we don't have, I said, I know they're not pictures, but to me, they're pictures. To me, there's nothing about that. And I mean, that's why I guess they're called characters and not words and all of these other things, right? And there's more to that maybe to unpack than just that, right? But I said, no, it's, to me, they are pictures. They are art forms. I associate it much more with like the beautiful Chinese calligraphy than I do with actual words almost, you know, and maybe that comes from my over-reliance on pinyin where I still kind of, I can see the pinyin is related to the word because it's related to the sound and it's how English works.
Oh,
but when I see the character, that's related to something else.
This is so interesting. This is really highlighting the reading like centric versus the sound centric, which I think is where you're coming from. Cause you seem to pick up language when you hear it and I pick it up when I can see it and read it. And for me, there's still a lot I don't know, but there are certain things that are so repetitive at this point that I need to see the characters to see the meaning in them because there's only like 200 some radicals and everything's based on that. It's just different versions of them. They could be squished, whatever, combined, all that kind of stuff. I'll have like my first layer of flashcards is like the Hanzi character, the word in just Hanzi characters, and then the pinyin, and I'll try to, and the English together, and I'll try to match it. And the first time I'm doing the matching, I'm staring at the characters looking for meaning clues without looking at anything else. And it's kind of fun. And it's not like it looks like it necessarily, but certain words, certain characters tend to mean, like there's one that tends to mean some sort of movement. There's another one that tends to mean some sort of cleaning or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yes, so there are cues within the character as to the meaning. And because I've never focused on them, I've never had, I don't see it when I look at them. And that's something that I would like to be able to see or would like to be able to develop. But I know that unless I actually sit down and put a lot of time into it, it won't happen.
It's a ton of time.
Whereas just kind of muddling my way through, now that I kind of have the amount that I have, is easier.
So I'm still floored. You've never taken classes. You've never... Like
so, okay, learned so that's not true.
Okay.
So my first year there, I did not take any classes. But then James and I started dating. I came back to Canada. Well, I came back to Canada and then we started dating. Not that that's relevant to this. Because long distance relationships are stupid, don't you know? Nobody would want to be in one of those.
But you left China and then you started dating long distance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a whole different podcast. Okay,
So then I went back the summer after I left. So I left in December 2016. I went back in the summer 2017, stayed with him and his family, and his parents don't speak any English. So James's English is quite good. But all of a sudden, I was living with people who didn't speak English. And I went from the kind of pretty self-conscious, uncomfortable. I always learned language in a school setting and I don't want to say it unless it's perfect. My Chinese is better than your English. So I guess that's what we've got to work with. And James's mom is a very talkative, patient person. And so she just kept trying. And James would come home from work and say, okay, can you just tell me how that conversation happened? Like, how did you guys figure this out together? I'd say, well, you know, one thing takes us a long time, but we get there. It reminded me of, there's this TED talk on like grandmothers in the cloud and this like video learning with kids with, I can't remember the name of the person, but anyway, and they said, really, they just need somebody to kind of be encouraging and patient.
Yeah.
And that was so much what James's mom was for me. She gave me a good model of that and then was just interested in talking. So that kind of happened. And then I went, okay, I need to be a little bit more intentional about this now. And I found a website, or I guess, you know, I guess now looking back, I guess it was a podcast. And I just didn't really know anything about podcasts then. The big thing that they are now.
I'm one right now.
Yeah, exactly. Come full circle. It was called Chinese Pod. It was all free. They had lessons and then they had these recordings that you could listen to. And so I was going to university at the time, and on the bus on the way to university and on the way home, I would listen to these Chinese Pod podcasts. And that helped me to focus in and start to, I think, kind of train my ear a little bit more, because they would break it down and slow things down and kind of explain the different parts of things. I remember frequently stopping for a moment and looking down on myself from outside of myself and going, you're walking down the street muttering in Mandarin, trying to copy whatever you hear on this podcast, as I was working on pronouncing different things.
You were shadowing. Yay.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, I must look insane right now, but that's what I was doing. So that was kind of how that went. So I did that for a little while and really enjoyed those. And then after that, I went, and our university had Mandarin classes, and I talked to the professor and said, look, I don't have time in my schedule and I'm not really interested in paying for a class, but could I attend the labs where you just, people practice and you're doing some of the work with it? Like, if, you know, if there's space, would it be okay if I sat in and just kind of audited that part of it? That was lovely. I didn't have to do anything for Mark, but that didn't matter for me. I just wanted a chance to kind of not lose the little bit that I had. That was probably the first time that I was interacting with the characters in a more formal way, because all of a sudden we had a textbook and were to look at that and, you know, make sense of it, make meaning from what was written there. Those were kind of the two extra things that I did.
Yeah. So in those auditory experiences, was the content very different than the conversations that you were having?
I still remember one of the Chinese Pod podcasts. So the phrase that they were teaching was something about like frying the shrimp or cooking the, and what it meant was that somebody had been fired. And I've never needed to actually know that in real life, but clearly it stuck with me. I still remember it because I thought it was an interesting idiom and kind of weird. So I would listen to them during the day, right? And then because of the time change between Canada and China, usually James and I would talk in the evening. And so in the evening, then I would say, this is what I learned today. Do you say this?
Yeah.
Or how is it different or how is it not or whatever. So I wouldn't say that all of the things were consistent with actual regular kind of spoken language. And certainly when I started that class at the university, it was a much more formal register than I was familiar with. And so learning about, you know, Mr. and Mrs. and blah, 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 blah. And I was going, no, like I didn't even know these words before and I've never used them. Although maybe I was not terribly polite sometimes looking back. But I was forgiven because of my lack of proficiency. Taking the university class was the first time when I kind of had some exposure to that more formal register.
Right.
And that was not necessarily in line with my day-to-day kind of experience and times when I might need to use Mandarin, but I think it helped to round it out a bit.
Gotcha. So how long did you do those for, those two things?
The Chinese Pod stuff, I think I did for about a year. Maybe two. And the Mandarin, I did the Mandarin classes that I would just kind of go sit in on for the practice. Yeah, I think it was two semesters. Let's say I think it was two semesters.
So cool. Like you practiced during the day and then you got to practice on the phone at night. So you got
And then I got to say, okay, yeah. Yeah, I got that application opportunity there.
There you go.
So our university had a language partner program for, really it was designed for learning English. But I went to them and said, hey, I just came back from China. Do do you have any people who speak Chinese who you could pair me with? I'm interested in maintaining my Chinese. And what they ended up doing was, rather than pair me with students at the university, they paired me with two of the partners of professors who were new to the university who were Chinese. Yeah. And so it ended up being two women who were there just kind of accompanying their husbands and had some time to meet. And so rather than meeting at the university necessarily, we would go out for coffee, or they would come to my house, or I would go to their house. And we got to do a little bit of a mix of English and Chinese so that I could learn a little bit and also just try to hold on to the little bit that I had.
With all the languages that you're describing, it sounds like you knew what you wanted to do with it and you sought out the opportunities to like practice those things.
Yeah, I think when it kind of came time to, you know, when I decided, hey, Mandarin's going to be a priority somewhat now and I'm not going to formally commit to it, in all of these other ways, I'm going to try to make sure that I can hold on to it however I can. And that kind of took me then to when I met you. I actually often credit that school with making a huge difference in my Mandarin language learning, because all of a sudden I was working in an office that was mixed. There were local Chinese people and there were foreign teachers, and the local Chinese people had very strong English. So I could speak Mandarin and throw English words in the middle of my sentences wherever I didn't know them, and they would understand. But I also had that environment where they were speaking to one another about things I knew something about because I was familiar with the context or the students or what was happening. And so even if it was kind of, you know, we're having a conversation all together as an office, and then they have their little side conversation, I know what led to that. So I have more opportunity to kind of figure out, you know, get meaning from it. That made a huge difference, both in building up my confidence in terms of speaking, but then also in broadening my vocabulary and all of that.
I'm so shocked to hear all of this, because I honestly just saw you as being fearless. You just walked in and you just started talking and I was like, look at her go.
Yeah, and I walked in and I was like, this is my chance.
That was amazing. And I don't even remember hearing you doing any blends at all. I didn't hear any English.
Oh, no.
Like, oh my God. You were probably when you got to the English, it was in the middle of the sentence. So there was like a little bit of Mandarin pronunciation in it or something.
Maybe. Yeah.
Have you ever dreamed in Chinese?
Yes. I don't know the rhyme or reason. I haven't noticed a pattern, and it hasn't happened very frequently. I used to say, like, if you're dreaming in the target language, you've made it. It's like all of a sudden your brain is actually kind of thinking in that language. You're not just translating back and forth.
Does it happen often?
I don't know. Now, I'm maybe not a good candidate to check that with. I rarely remember my dreams. So I rarely have a sense of my dreams, even in English. I don't think very often. There's the language that I'm dreaming in, it's English. And that's still the majority of my day as well. I'm not sure if I went back to China and lived there for a year again, if that would shift.
Well, let's talk about Morgan, because he keeps coming in the conversation. I've heard so many different methods that multilingual households on how they handle growing up bilingually. What is your guys' plan of attack on this?
Influence from school and peers and this whole idea of the English environment that they're in, wanting to fit in and wanting to be a part of that ends up overpowering it. And it's, I think often it's not until, you know, they're 18 or they're in their 20s and they go, God, I wish I had done this when I was a kid, right? Yep. And all of a sudden there's other priorities in life. And so my hope is that although I have an accent when I speak Mandarin, and it's certainly not perfect by any means, and I'm still learning, that the fact that I want to speak Mandarin and that we kind of validate that language in that sense in our home with me not being Chinese, but still wanting to speak it, will help to give him more of an example of it being something desirable. And then just giving him more of that environment. So this past summer, James's parents actually came to visit for 2 months. And that was huge for him. And we hope that will be able to happen again, so that he get, because they don't speak English, he can have that really rich language.
Yeah, we're talking about you.
So the other side of that is that I still speak to him a lot in English. And certainly in things where I want to be specific and clear, yeah. I use English. Right now, he has a couple of words, but it's decent, and it definitely got a lot stronger this summer with James's parents being here. You know, right now he's learning like nose and eyes and mouth, and he'll touch them when you say them, and he'll do that in English and in Mandarin.
Remind me, is he two and a half?
He's 19 months, so he's 19 and a half. This summer we spent a lot of time going outside, and he started to say go, like let's go, and yeah. he'd go, 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 go. But then after James's parents arrived, I realized whenever he saw a dog, he also said go, because go is dog, right? Yeah. And so, yeah. but he wouldn't say them differently. He would say it the same.
Aww.
I'm still breastfeeding. Yeah. And if he wants to nurse, he'll ask in Chinese. So he'll say nai, chenai. You go chenai. Nai. Yeah, he's not going to say it now. He's like, no, just let me nurse. But maybe
he's like, forget this recording pressure. I'm done with it.
And when James's parents were here, he would say, sometimes he would say mayo. Like when he couldn't find anything, he would go mayo.
That's but so cute.
That's the extent of his Mandarin and English so far. He's got a few body parts and then a couple other. But I was really actually relieved when there were a couple of Mandarin words that came through, because it is kind of an experiment and you never know how it's going to go, right?
Let's wrap up by talking about your teaching. What's happening? What are you doing? What are you teaching right now?
I work mostly doing English language support with international students at an all-girls boarding school here in Winnipeg. In any year, we tend to have between 50 and 60 international students who board at the school. I do mostly English language support with them, and I'm lucky to be able to do that most of the time in fairly small groups, so often like groups of 5 to 10. And we do a lot of work with kind of the productive side of things, because they're all quite strong students and do a lot of reading and listening in their classes all day because they're immersed in English in that sense. But because they are immersed with a whole bunch of other students who are very strong English language users, they don't always necessarily have the confidence to join in. So our time together is often used to give them opportunities to kind of develop their ideas around things. And we usually focus on some of the academic topics that they're doing in their other classes and just use that as a jumping off point for our focus on language. So when they're doing their labs for biology, they need to use passive voice. So then we talk about passive voice and kind of why they would need to use it then and how it would be useful. And then we take a look at their labs and do some work around that. That's fun. Just this year, for the first year, I'm teaching microeconomics, which is not as much of a language focus. There are only 3 people in my class of 13 who are not Chinese. Obviously, I teach the class in English, but when I'm working one-on-one with students, we're able to have conversations in Mandarin as well to make sure that they get that depth of understanding of the content area. Right. And then we work on the making sure that they can communicate that in English for a test or an assignment or whatever.
So your finance Chinese must be pretty high for to be able to do that.
No, I am a muddler, as we've established. There is lots of language in terms of economics that I am not familiar with, but they are somewhat familiar with it. So they use those words and I use my words. Mm. And we kind of find a way that works. And so it's fun for me because I'm learning new words in Mandarin as a product of teaching this course from China. When I came back to Canada, I thought, I don't know how I'm going to keep up my Mandarin. I kind of happened into this job and I went, I think I might be okay. I use it as an asset that I can connect with students in this way. And so they're supportive. I mean, obviously, I don't speak in Mandarin with them all the time. But again, just in terms of kind of validating that language, and when the purpose is communicating, not learning English, that we have an opportunity to do that as well.
Sure. They are bilingual. They don't have to pretend to just speak one language when they're there.
Exactly.
What annoys me about at the university level. I understand international students need to be fluent in the local language in order to do the content classes, but they don't have to pretend they don't have the other languages that used to frustrate.
One of the things that is kind of a focus of mine within this kind of school community conversations, whatever, with my colleagues is really thinking about a more additive approach to language, right? Rather than having that kind of deficiency model. It's not that they don't have English. It's that they are fully fluent in one language and now they're also learning how to communicate in this other one. And we're working on that, but this is in addition to. It's we don't pretend that the rest doesn't exist.
Yeah, there was kind of a stigma when we were teaching in university. The heritage students, which was a polite word for nobody wants to teach them because they came in with bilingual, like Spanish and English usually. They were super interesting kids who had had multiple life experiences. They were really honest and interesting, and they had seen things. You know, they weren't sheltered at all. And I loved teaching them. But people were just like, oh, just I can't handle it. Oh, their language is so bad. And I'm like, what? Because they express themselves too much? Like,
It was because you're actually getting language from them.
Right. Yeah. So the more language you get, I guess you would notice more mistakes since you're super quiet native speakers who only have one language and are very careful to never use it. Yeah, you wouldn't hear any mistakes.
Right.
All the teachers that complained were monolingual. And I'm like, wait. So these kids who come in with two languages, both strong but not perfect to you, and you're sitting there as a monolingual judging them.
Yeah, that idea of kind of, especially within English language learning environments, of that primacy of English over everything else, rather than seeing it as just one of many ways of communicating.
Yes.
It's a very ethnocentric perspective on learning and life. I think I used to have that perspective and think of it in a fairly positive way, or at least benevolent way, I don't know. But now I'm starting to get more critical of it and thinking that in some ways it's also a way of preserving our sense of ourselves as authority figures. But I think that a lot of teachers, rather than allowing themselves to be vulnerable or acknowledging that it's because they're uncomfortable and they feel vulnerable, they want to say it's a problem with the student.
I think there is a vulnerability. And I think there is, especially for folks who may have never really been lost in a culture that they don't know the language of. It's their first time of, I don't know what's happening right now.
Yes,
and with their students in a classroom where they may already feel like, I don't know if I have control of this class, which you never really do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's problem number one without any language. But yeah, I think it's definitely their issues because honestly, I thought it was cool. Like I finally was able to teach the international student section the second year of grad school. And I was like, this is awesome. I have kids from like 6 or 7 different countries in the same year.
Fascinating.
And so I'd say, how is this like in Kazakhstan? What is this like in Yemen? Like, tell me the da-da. And they're like, well, can I use a little bit of language to tell you this? And I'm like, of course you can. You're going to need to explain it to the rest of us. But using that word for that thing that you're talking about, that's important.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so used to that being just pushed aside. No, tell us in English. But it doesn't exist in English.
Exactly. So how could they? So use the word. Let's all learn and appreciate and hear that word.
Yeah.
And then explain to us what it means, the closest approximation you can in English, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They were seriously like, can I do that in a classroom? And I'm like, heck yeah. If you don't in your other classrooms, you should probably be pushing it a little bit more because this is ridiculous. This is a university. We're supposed to be learning here.
Yes, this should be an environment for learning and for pushing these boundaries, right? And being more open-minded about things. I mean, if that's what we want to say that we do there.
So wait, that one microeconomics class, when you said it was 10 Chinese students and 3 non-Chinese students, is that like a representation of the school as a whole?
No, normally it would be, let's say, maybe 20 students and maybe 5 of them would be international. We're less than 50% international, far less than 50% international.
Oh, okay.
I think because many of our Chinese international students are interested in taking business and so are wanting to take this AP micro course. It's one that is perceived to be less language focused. Our international students from China, not always, but overall tend to kind of fit that stereotype of being more comfortable in math.
On this podcast, I interview 2 different populations, I suppose we should say. Folks that either learned or are learning Mandarin Chinese as adults or teenagers, adults, whatever age they are. And the other group is folks that grew up with the language and they learned other languages, specifically English, because that's that I ask them questions in.
Yeah.
So with those 2 populations in mind, are there any questions you can think of that I haven't asked you that might be interesting to ask other people in the future?
Hey, this is Future Steph. So Angela wanted some time to think about her question, and she sent me her reply via WeChat, which is the messaging app in China. Well, it's the app in China. So the sound is a little bit different, but I think you'll find the question that she adds to the changing scripts interview question to be rather interesting. So here you go.
But I guess my question would be what the attitudes towards language learning were of the people around them. So their families or friends or whatever, was language learning something, you know, were the other people in their lives also language learners, or were they just completely monolingual? Did they think that it was interesting or important for them to learn another language, or was it just kind of viewed as something extra and not really that big a deal? I'm curious about how kind of the perceptions of language learning from the people around them or people close to them may have impacted their language learning journey.
Thank you so much, Angela and Morgan, for joining us on the Changing Scripts podcast.
Thank you. It was fun.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Dill, and I'm an avid Mandarin Chinese language learner and, of course, a big fan of the show. Now, I'll be a future guest on the Changing Scripts podcast. I'm currently studying HSK5, so I hopefully represent what you two can achieve in the short to midterm of your language learning journey. Now, Steph has asked me to help out with a few quick thank yous. So firstly, I'd like to thank our guest, Angela, and a special thank you to Tom of the Tom Reads Instagram feed for his amazing podcast break. Now, the music in this podcast is from Damon Castillo and his album Mess of Me, which you can find all of his music at damoncastillo.com. And finally, a massive thank you to you guys, the listeners. It's because of you and your interest in language stories that Steph and her guests continue to record these conversations. She looks forward to all of your feedback at Steph Fuccio on any of the social media platforms and, of course, Gmail. And be sure to keep an eye out for my episode on season 4 of the Changing Scripts podcast starting on July 2019.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.